My paper is a sort of cobbled together series of bits for my book, I suppose. But I'm also trying, I suppose, to kind of think a bit about what happens afterwards in terms of how one thinks about the relationship between the British Empire in India and kind of sort of the post-imperial regimes. And I think I'd have liked to have had more to say about that in this paper than I'm going to. But you know, kind of, I do have a little bit to say here. So. My title, I've India Conquered and Unconquered, and I've got some bits I'm going to read and some where I'll sort of like ad lib a bit more. So historians write the history of their own times as much as the times whose dates appear on the cover of their books. Depending on the biographies of their authors, the histories of South Asia written recently have been inflected through Ayodhya and the rise of the Hindu right, September the 11th, or the global financial crisis. But I think one can go further than that in thinking about how we think about about the colonial state. The history of British India's last 50 or so years, in particular, is still very heavily inflected by themes dominant in the late 1960s and 1970s, when the generation of scholars now retiring wrote their PhDs. The so-called Cambridge School and Subaltern Studies, two sort of possibly now superseded kind of, but once dominant sort of ways of thinking about South Asia, both shared a common account of the relationship between elites and the state, which to some degree is still with us, which they both see as enduring from long before 1947. For the former, a group of historians based in Cambridge in particular, the relationship between elites and the imperial state was transactional, based on the shared gains from collaboration between various dominant agrarian and urban elites and the imperial regime. For the latter, for subaltern historians and kind of another set of traditions, the relationship between elites and the imperial Indian elites and the imperial state was ideological, rooted in a common commitment to a vision of modernity which had its ultimate origins in the West, however much it might have been recast to meet South Asian circumstances. Kind of want to start off though by suggesting that both of these literature argue that in differing degrees imperial power had some kind of roots in Indian society, even though they're roots that were limited to a small elite. In the words of both Antonio, to use the word that Ranajit Guha drew from Antonio Gramsci, the imperial state relied upon the imperial regime's hegemony over a collaborating elite, but not over the rest of the population. So as Guha puts it, peace between the rulers and the ruled was mediated to no mean extent by the indigenous elite. So from this kind of perspective that I'm talking about, the process of decolonization saw an elite transfer allegiance from the imperial regime to national institutions. The kind of most important, I suppose, consequence of this is that I think we still, to some degree, to a large extent, see this is the kind of dominant frame, is that the transfer of sovereignty in 1947 or whenever it actually occurred didn't fundamentally transform the distribution of power in South Asian society. I want to suggest, so open by mentioning the kind of 1960s and 1970s, by suggesting that these arguments, these ways of thinking about the relationship between the imperial state and the kind of post-colonial state emerged from an intellectual milieu in the 1960s and 1970s, in which a critique of the post-imperial nation state, particularly in India, was rife. This is the period, the 60s and 70s, late 60s and early 70s, in which an intellectual consensus emerged about the failure of South Asia's nation states to meet the promises of liberation. Left and right alike challenged India's democracy as a soft state, and that's a phrase I'm going to come back to at the end of my talk, to use Gunnar Myrdal's infamous phrase. Intellectuals writing from this perspective argued that the government, the state, was incapable of imposing the necessary revolutionary change or discipline, or both, because it was beholden to an old imperial comprador class. To take two examples of this kind of critique of the post-colonial state, which I'm arguing was influential in how we think about imperialism, from opposite sides of the political spectrum. In 1970, the communist P.C. Joshi argued that the dominance of a, quote, traditional landed elite meant that India's power elites show a reluctance to decisively intervene in favour of the weak against the strong. 4 years later, the liberal Arun Shauri, is he still a liberal? Who knows? Yes, I think he is, actually, condemned the desire of India's elites to, quote, leave existing configurations of power undisturbed. Even if they impoverished India's majority population. The dominant refrain in each case from the left to the right, and for commentators throughout the debate, was that the nation state was not sufficiently national, and this remains an important kind of theme. India's post-independence Congress government was accused of not having the interests of the population as a whole in mind in its actions, ruling instead in the interests of more or less the same wealthy and privileged groups which had benefited from empire. So the legacy of this intellectual response to South Asia's 1970s, and at the end I'm going to come back to thinking about those a little if I've got time, was a very peculiar view, I want to suggest, of the imperial regime, which to some degree remains with us today. The colonial state, that those words are in inverted commas, is regarded as a set of structures of, and discourses, to use Shudip to cover our phrase from an influential article, which extended far beyond the narrow necessities of maintaining the fact of British sovereignty in India. There are different versions of this argument, of course, but they all tend to see colonialism as a coherent force which partially enlisted some sections of India's population as allies to dominate the rest of South Asian society. So from this point of view, the colonial regime aspired to do more than simply dominate. Like its post-imperial successor, it attempted to develop, to transform, to integrate India into Europe's bourgeois political order, as Kavaraj puts it. It was, of course, unsuccessful, and the kind of thrust of these different arguments, Subaltern studies, etc., is to talk about failure. They're all about failure, but there is an attempt to kind of integrate. So it was unsuccessful, of course, as Kavaraj's words again, the British Empire's effort at hegemony, quote, singularly failed in carrying this ideological relay down towards the people. The colonial state was incapable of creating the kind of dialogue with a population necessary for widespread, successful social change. But like the independent Indian state, and what I'm arguing is that the colonial state is seen as an even worse version, if you like, an even greater version of the post-colonial state that's even less successful. The colonial regime was characterised by an intention to both subjugate and transform, which was always going to fail. And my point is that the imperial state actually is something quite different. So the use of the word colonial to describe the British state in India is significant, I think. And we still all do it, don't we? We talk about the colonial state. It suggests a regime based on the settlement of a population and the creation of permanent economic dependence, a series of kind of power relationships that extend far beyond kind of political sovereignty. Colonialism, you know, empire might be about political sovereignty, but colonialism is about something broader than that. Colonial power is treated as something far more extensive than the mere exercise of political sovereignty. The danger, I think, in using that word is that it becomes very difficult to discern where colonialism, empire, whatever, begins and where it ends. And I think there's an extraordinary absence from until recently at least, there's been an extraordinary absence from the historiography of the colonial state. It has nothing at all to say about the British conquest of India, and very little to say about imperial violence. Until quite recently, our histories of British rule in India have been remarkably bloodless. The assertion of British power has been described through the extension of trade between imperial officers and Indian intermediaries, or through the spread of colonial discourse, or a modern regime of power, through the extension of a range of different academic and administrative institutions, but not through the exercise of force by British armies. Now, over the last couple of decades, particularly the last few years, violence has returned to the academic discussion of British India. And my argument, I suppose, is this needs to more fundamentally reflected in the way in which we think about the imperial state. So it's now vital sort of Elizabeth Kolsky's work to our understanding of the everyday lives of British settlers administrators. There's been a new focus on the violent tactics the imperial state used against Indian resistance. There's a whole spectrum of work around that. In moments of crisis, also a post-9/11 interest in the imperial antecedents of more recent counterinsurgency strategies. We've also seen a spate of works concerned with the use of India as a military labour market and resource base in the effort to deploy violence against the Ottoman Empire and then Japanese Empire in two 20th century world wars. And I suggest that these different literatures are beginning to challenge the kind of perception of the colonial state that I began with. And in the process, show, and I guess this is the main argument of India Conquered, my book, that violence is not merely for this state a tactic or an effect of a form of power which is governed by, driven by another logic, modernity, capitalism, or whatever. So violence is not a way in which kind of people do something else. It's not a means to an end. It was instead intrinsic to the relationship between ruler and ruled in the subcontinent. Many Britons in India saw their presence as about maintaining the continual possibility of violently subjugating the people they ruled. So violence has this kind of circular quality. The purpose of the imperial regime is to maintain a regime that is capable of exercising violence over its subjects, even though obviously it's not doing that all the time. In Awadh or Delhi in 1857, or at Amritsar in 1919, it's quite hard to discern the ulterior purpose to violence. There aren't a set of interests or logic external to the exercise of force which might explain its use. So violence was used to reaffirm the existence of a political authority which had, as I just said, little purpose other than to maintain its continual capacity to use violence. Yet the institutions of imperial sovereignty are still characterized by scholars as a colonial state. That's the title we use in our courses and literature and so forth. We still imagine British India as a system of power with, albeit usually unsuccessful, aspirations to economic and cultural domination. So my aim today is to challenge that account of British power in India, and in the process offer some kind of thoughts about how we might think about the end of British rule and its successors. Building on the literatures I just mentioned, my thoughts today aim towards a recharacterization of the British regime in India, not as an attempt, the attempt at colonial domination, but instead as a physical, but also in many ways more limited, the physical, but in many ways more limited effort to establish and maintain political sovereignty through conquest. If the British possessed a state at all in India, it was a conquest state, concerned from at least the early 19th century to maintain the forceful subordination of India's peoples and political forces to British political power. And if British rule was about maintaining the physical sovereignty of British power, not economic or cultural domination, its decline and transfer, the end of empire, can be seen as a far more greater rupture than we might otherwise imagine it to be. So I'm going to talk a bit about the kind of colonial state and how I describe the conquest state in India conquered. We know that Britain's connection to India began with trade, with the attempt to tap into sort of Asian markets. But it was always exercised through a kind of sovereign, from the very beginning, it's exercised through a sovereign political body, the East India Company, which from the very beginning, from the kind of early 17th century in particular, the late 17th century, was anxious about its kind of sort of monopolistic rights and its ability to exercise political power. So from very early on, commerce, British prestige and kind of sovereignty become entangled within one another. There's always within kind of sort of British imperial ideas and discourses a kind of critique from merchants, from people interested in kind of profiting from India about the kind of the ways in which the East India Company and then the kind of Raj's kind of political power is unnecessary to the sort of, empire's economic project. Of course, at the beginning, there's no attempt to conquer the whole of South Asia. But there is from the beginning an attempt to establish kind of sort of firm, secure political settlements. And then there's a kind of logic that I argue is unable to kind of create a stable balance of power without domination, through the sort of 18th century. And that it's, Britain becomes, the dominant political power, it conquers India because of that kind of logic of anxious expansion, that there's no resting place, there's no stable position where kind of British officials can sort of live alongside kind of sort of Indian political authorities, logic kind of sort of intersects with kind of sort of, I guess, the careers of kind of individuals of Britons, for whom empire is a kind of East is a career, as that phrase. Particular kind of moments of political crisis in the history of the Mughal regime and its successors, the reliance on the fact that the British have access to credit and can fund armies and so forth on a scale that no other states can. None of that is news to anyone really. But I want to kind of offer a slightly different chronology of conquest. In my attempt to sort of revise how we think about the imperial state in India, and the usual story is something like, you have a kind of period of British fighting, of conflict driven by whatever forces are seen as important, through the late 18th century, from the Battle of Plassey or whatever to the early 19th century, kind of possibly to 1818, India is conquered in 1818, and then after that, and this is Eric Stokes in the English Utilitarians in India, saying that the principal task was now to devise an effective and economical administration for the vast areas suddenly annexed to the company's territories. And we have this very sort of, conquest happens and suddenly there's a state and suddenly you have kind of British power consolidated. And I want to kind of challenge that and suggest that, we need to extend the process of conquest until 1857, until the kind of Great North Indian Insurrection, in the years from you know, 1818 kind of onwards, there's, you know, continual conflict, concern, you know, kind of political anxiety on India's frontiers, so war in Burma, obviously Punjab, and so forth. You know, kind of, but I think more importantly than that, kind of the kind of violence, the kind of resistance, I suppose, to kind of to British power that did come from kind of large, well-organized states, the Marathas, Mysore, etc., kind of fragments, but doesn't diminish. And you have the British fighting a series of sort of small wars against local chieftains, local rulers, and so forth, who'd detach themselves from former political systems and tried to establish some kind of autonomy. And so the state that you see through much of the kind of, through the first half of the 19th century remains a kind of a state engaged in the kind of active process of conquest. It's still led by sort of warriors more than it isn't. So, you know, whether it's Lord Hastings or Lord Harding, there's kind of a particular group of people around the Duke of Wellington who are important, providing there's a military ideology really, which British power is based on. Military expenditure is kind of still the overwhelming cost of the British state, and you know, kind of interestingly, the number of soldiers in that the British are paying kind of increases after 1818. So we have this idea that 1818 is the final end of conquest. Well, no, in 1818 there are 244,000 soldiers in the kind of combined British armies in India. In 1826 there's 292,000, and the kind of year. It's 1826 that is the year when actually, as a proportion of the government, the British government in India's total revenue, there's more money is being spent on the military than it was even in the years of the kind of Great Rebellion. So a kind of recasting how one sees the kind of pre-1857 period to see, conquest is essential, and there I think we need to recalibrate how we think about things like, you know, the age of reform, so-called utilitarianism, and see them as about an effort to assert some kind of systematic unitary form of sovereignty against kind of forces capable of challenging kind of sort of British conquest. And if you look at the kind of, and I trace this in kind of the book, if you look at the story that emerges around the creation of things like kind of universal law codes, you know, kind of the idea of codifying law and so forth. One really important kind of driving force within that is an attempt to prevent conflict between different jurisdictions, and in particular kind of sort of the use by populations, Marathas, etc., you know, kind of political lineages and so forth that kind of might, undermine kind of British power. So my kind of sort of potted history of the kind of British conquest state, kind of one needs to then rethink how one thinks about 1857 and see it not as a kind of moment of kind of sort of unanticipated rebellion against a stable, increasingly interventionist kind of regime, but as the final sequence in the sort of cycles of violence, often chaotic and irrational cycles of violence, which the succession of sort of actions and responses through which kind of Indian British power is extended in India. It was proof to the British that kind of, India, British India was always what most of them thought it was, which is that it's not a kind of normal political society, but instead it's a society that needs to be governed by the sword, somewhere that is under a form of kind of military despotism. It's proof too, I think, that violence is something that doesn't have an ulterior motive beyond kind of their exercise of sovereignty and the capacity to exercise violence. So, it's quite hard to identify what the sort of strategic, political, economic, and other goals are in kind of sort of suppressing the kind of rebellion of 1857, other than the desire to kind of not for British power to be challenged, which is a kind of circular logic. Violence is something that is, you know, in 1857, 1858, and subsequently, and before and afterwards, is something that's emotional. It has an emotional register. It's not about kind of rational interests. It's I just examined an excellent PhD by a student at Queen Mary, Jacob Smith, who argues that kind of the British violence against the rebels of 1857 and afterwards is all about retribution. There's a way in which kind of there's a sort of legitimization of retribution. So this is not, as I've said, kind of about some kind of tactic that's exercised in the name of interests external to armed force. Yet kind of this moment of conquest, this final moment of conquest in 1857, 1858, allows something that isn't too dissimilar from a kind of from what the British would have regarded as a normal state to emerge, you know, kind of as they would have understood it in the kind of late 19th century. You know, kind of power is still dispersed, you know, kind of one still has, you know, princely states, kind of complicated networks of authority outside of direct formal British authority. But you have the emergence of I suppose, the kind of modern systems of modern government, you know, kind of railways, tax system, you know, more intense forms of tax collection, you know, stamp duty. The kind of the British are obsessed by, you know, kind of the extension of kind of sort of the sign of the sovereign, I suppose, on the kind of small transactions that you know, kind of that allow the economy to function and so forth. So, and if I can hand these around, I've only got 10 of these, but this is the East Indica, a statement of expenditure in the kind of late 1880s and early 1890s. But there are peculiarities, though, about this regime. You know, kind of it has kind of characteristics that I think are worth pointing out. The kind of post-mutiny regime is peculiarly interested in the physical assertion, the visible and physical assertion of power. That's what it spends its money on. That's what it's interested in doing. So it's no longer a state that is simply interested in kind of sort of in the military, in kind of the army, although, you know, kind of the army takes up 26% of its expenditure. But it is interested in other forms of power that are, you know, kind of about, I guess, a kind of material authority. So there's a peculiar kind of materialism to British power. The most important sign of that is the utterly insignificant amount of money paid on education or on, you know, sort of anything that is kind of mental, you know, cultural, etc. And you can see my kind of challenge here back to sort of the dominant ways in which we tend to think about the imperial state, the kind of the marginal place of cultural imperialism or whatever within the sort of formal exercise of British power. The railways become more important, and they're about kind of displaying authority and about creating a kind of sort of networks of physical authority, you know, sort of far more than they are about any kind of sense of economic interests. You know, kind of irrigation systems similarly, you know, kind of, so that there are sort of a series of sort of devices, I guess, by which kind of the British kind of assert their power, sovereignty, I suppose, over the kind of material world, more than they do over kind of people, and more than they certainly are interested in engaging in any kind of dialogue with even India's kind of elite. So there is some kind of welfare state, and I you know, kind of want to argue that, you know, kind of in this sort of late 19th, kind of sort of early 20th century kind of imperial regime, it's famine relief. You know, kind of there is a, you know, an extensive series of institutions that grow, you know, kind of take up sort of in these statistics here about 2% of expenditure, kind of. But its job is to maintain the kind of bare survival of a population, you know, kind of rather than anything else. And so if you like, there's a kind of a materialism even in the way in which the kind of the British regime engages with the kind of mass of its subjects. It's about bodies. It's about maintaining kind of sort of the capacity of bodies to reproduce themselves rather than anything kind of beyond that. So you know, and if you compare. Compare the kind of sort of way in which British expenditure is, you know, kind of British taxes are spent, you know, kind of, then you see that, for example, education is still obviously not a massive function of the kind of late 19th century British state, but it's far more, defence is far less, and kind of the kind of public works projects that I'm talking about as a major element of kind of what the imperial state does in the kind of late 19th century are paid for by private means. They're things that actually, that the railways are, you know, don't rely upon direct government, you know, direct taxation and so forth. So the peculiarity of the imperial state compared to kind of sort of you know, regimes at the same time are that it's kind of it's interested in engaging with the material world. It's materialistic. So you know, kind of very few of its actions occur through what Sudip Tukavaraj calls dialogic relations, even with a kind of between the sort of British ruling class and an Indian elite. As I said, it's obsessed with the physical signs of its power, railways, irrigation systems, and of course, you know, kind of increasingly pageantry, and, you know, kind of you have the Durbars and, the, you know, so forth, and that's all about that same kind of, you know, physical display. Of course, you know, there's a beginning of some kind of local government functions, but, you know, kind of this is a regime that kind of, again, compared with other regimes, is, you know, extraordinary, has, you know, there's an extraordinary small amount of kind of sort of authority existing in sort of local government units, you know, sort of. So the relationship to kind of the subjects of this regime is not even the kind of elite subjects, the kind of sort of famous Indian middle class, not as partners or as collaborators, but above all else as employees, as people with whom it has a purely transactional relationship, soldiers, clerks, railway officials, masons, and so forth. And kind of sort of, you know, India's elites and others kind of have a series of sort of choices to make about what their relationship is going to be. Do they submit? Do they, you know, kind of seek a livelihood in relationship to this, to being paid by, you know, kind of this set of institutions? Do they challenge the British, or, and in the process, kind of sort of, you know, most likely be sort of defeated? Or do they, and this is kind of, I think, the most significant process, kind of create kind of modes of life that exist at some kind of distance from British power? You know, kind of confrontation. This is a regime that's capable of repressing, you know, kind of moments of visible confrontational, often with kind of sort of force on an irrational scale. You know, kind of 1857 is a kind of sort of is something that is strongly in people's memory. You know, kind of other moments kind of sort of play a similar role, I think, in sort of creating kind of a sense of the failure of kind of violent resistance. So Vasudev Balamant Phadke's revolt in 1879, in a moment of particular kind of imperial crisis, Pune is important, talked about a lot. You know, kind of, and I think, you know, kind of, the violent challenge is not kind of, is not something that's kind of widespread. But as I said, there's space, because this is a regime that is interested in kind of physical, the assertion of kind of physical power. It's a kind of not interested in sort of cultural domination. It's not, it doesn't have the kind of complicated sort of networks and systems that we sort of imagine, you know, empire, you know, kind of. It's being based on kind of, there is kind of space for quasi-autonomous Indian activity within the sort of interstices of empire. So the violent, materialistic but limited character of British power profoundly shaped the way South Asia's subjects responded. It powerfully inflected the way Britain's modernity was characterised, for example, violence and materialism being commonly identified elements. I think there's a kind of history to be written of the ways in which kind of the very particular ways in which people write about this very abstract kind of supposedly global process in South Asia. As we know, the last couple of decades of the 19th century saw the growth of new institutional forms concerned to develop the autonomous life of different groups of India's population, educational institutions, religious reform movements, businesses, and so on. Britain's conquest state offered spaces for subjects to develop these new forms of institutional life in a complicated way. But it also posed a set of dilemmas about how people engaged with British power. The violence of the imperial state destroyed most of India's pre-imperial political institutions. The 1857 rebellion demonstrated the futility of rallying to pre-British Mughal or Maratha authority. If people were to restore a sense of their dignity, power needed restoring on a new basis in spheres of life which would not constantly be challenged by the imperial state. But where so many walks of life were influenced by imperial systems and regulations, whether it's stamp duty or whatever, knowing where to draw the line was hard. Public work, quote, to raise living standards or nurture self-respect was impossible without compromises with imperial power. Withdrawal into purely indigenous spaces, as proposed, for example, by the Gurukul faction of the Arya Samaj in the late 19th century, which attempted to create Vedic schools in the Himalayas, was one strategy, but which allowed the soul to stay pure and be regenerated, but had little immediate impact. So my argument is that what unified most strands of Indian thinking critical of the imperial regime from the late 19th century was a concern to overcome or undo the conquest of India. India sought to exercise power for themselves against the British, but in doing so, they also wanted to change and challenge the way power was exercised in the subcontinent. So the dominant strand of nationalism in India between 1890 and the early 1920s was concerned with peaceful institution building, to regenerate one of India's plurality of social and political communities. involving the creation of multiple pockets of quasi-independent authority. These didn't explicitly challenge British power, but they did make British officers nervous. The Arya Samaj, which I mentioned, with its inward-looking concern to regenerate Hindu ethical life, was one example. As Lala Lajpat Rai noted, the quote, foreign rulers of India have never been happy about the Arya Samaj because of its independence of tone and its propaganda of self-confidence, self-help and self-reliance. He went on, the British cannot look with favour on an indigenous movement, which according to them can do big things without their help or guidance, and which has established a sort of government within governments. And that's my argument about the kind of the project of late 19th, early 20th century Indian nationalism. It's interested in creating governments within governments. The point, though, is that there were many other similar institutions to the Arya Samaj. So I want to pay attention to Lala Lajpat Rai for a moment, as he typifies the kind of response to conquest that I'm talking about. The son of a Hindu teacher of Urdu, he was born in a small town between Delhi and Lahore in 1865 and became a successful lawyer while also helping to organise the Arya Samaj. In his mid-20s, he was part of the group that built the Dayananda Anglo-Vedic College. He then worked on a range of projects, founding orphanages to rescue destitute Hindu children from the grip of famine and Christian missionaries, working to relieve hill dwellers made homeless by earthquake, and helping create India's earliest nationalist insurance company and bank. This latter work, the founding of a bank, of cooperative endeavour, as he called it, was perhaps Lala Lajpat Rai's most enduring legacy. Like other political leaders in late 19th century Punjab, Lajpat Rai noted that money earned from the province's expanding agricultural society was, quote, being used to run English banks instead of being ploughed into Indian enterprise. The solution was to create Indian-run financial institutions which would encourage moral regeneration as well as support the wealth of the province. At the insistence of a friend, Lajpat Rai sent a memorandum to a group of leading men in Punjab, lawyers, educationalists and government officers, Sikhs, Parsis and members of the religion of the Brahmo Samaj, as well as Arya Samajists, urging them to deposit capital in a new financial institution. The Punjab National Bank started business in 1894 with Lajpat Rai's brother as its first manager. Its name expressed the complicated relationship between nation and sub-national identities in the politics of late 19th century self-reliance. National work should be directed to developing one's own community first. Creating a bank just for Punjab was work that would benefit the Indian nation. The result was an institution that's endured to the present day and is now India's third largest financial institution. Lajpat Rai believed this style of institution building would supersede the violent warmongering politics that he associated with the British regime in particular and the West in general. Europe was in constant war right up to the 19th century, he wrote. Europe had exported its violent men of genius, its men of daring and dash, who cared little for the wrongs with which they inflict on others to India. In contrast to the cathartic violence that he argued had been unleashed by the British, Lajpat Rai thought India needed to celebrate its own history of peaceful civilization and rational social development. Long before Gandhi had begun to dominate the public stage, nationalists like Lajpat Rai based their arguments for Indian self-reliance on a critique of the place of force in politics. Their general spirit, Lajpat Rai said of his compatriots, is opposed to all kinds of violence. In place of the aggressive sovereign power of the British regime, Lajpat Rai celebrated the peaceful self-organising capacity of India's many different societies. This critique of the logic of conquest led Lajpat Rai to sharply criticise Indians who celebrated the martial prowess of their own communities, and first of all that involved Syed Ahmed Khan. When I last gave a paper here, I talked a lot about Syed Ahmed Khan, and this is kind of the sequel. Syed criticised the newly founded Indian National Congress for its lack of martial honour. Mughals and Rajputs, he said, who had not forgotten the swords of their ancestors, were being encouraged to submit to Bengali clerks who at the sight of a table knife would crawl under their chair. Syed thought the warrior aristocracy of North India needed to acknowledge its defeat, this is Faisal's argument, by British arguments and submit to British authority, but could still be proud of its own martial history in creating its own sort of way of life independently of the British regime through that move. But by contrast, Lajpat Rai argued that the literature, philosophy and science of the Mughal past needed to be celebrated, not war. India was the land of peaceful improvement, of reason rather than passion and conflict, he thought. No race ever complained of its having been ruined by a Rajput invasion. It is time, he argued, that the followers of the Prophet should be proud of their ancestors, not on account of their conquests, but on account of their great efforts in the dissemination of knowledge in the world. And so there's an attempt to tell a political story about India which kind of doesn't have a positive role for conquest within it, because it's the British that is the conquering state. Paradoxically, these criticisms of the self-appointed guardian of the Mughal Empire's martial glory might have been influenced by Mughal traditions of thought. And again, I'm referring to some of Faisal's work. There's a direct line of there is a direct line of influence. Lajpat Rai's father taught the language of Mughal government. His ancestors worked as Mughal officials. Lajpat Rai himself was always himself much more comfortable writing in Persian characters than the Devanagari script. Like Mughal writers, Lajpat Rai saw India as a community of communities. He stressed the importance of compromise and balance between the interests of different groups. His thinking linked up then, and with the idea of preserving the distinction of different communities that was so central to the resistance of 1857's rebels to British power. But unlike the rebels of 1857, Lajpat Rai thought that India's plural communities could form some kind of single nation. And although it's fuzzy, complicated, what he meant by that, and his understanding changes. Centuries of coexistence meant India's different societies collectively formed what he calls a single geographical, cultural and historical entity. He said. But Lajpat Rai's nation was a composite entity made up of the half-merged aspirations of different sub-nations. Each needed to develop on its own terms, he said. A country, he wrote, consisting of Hindus, Mohammedans, Christians and others cannot be said to be progressing unless all the component parts of it contribute to the progress of the whole. So what mattered was that the moral and social life of each part of the nation grew in its own way together. What could not happen was for solidarity to be forced by the coercive powers of the state. Like many early nationalists, Lajpat Rai was far more interested in social organisation, and this is the key point, than state power. He was very flexible about the type of government which should rule in India as a consequence. So until the end of the First World War, Lajpat Rai thought India's national regeneration could occur within the British Empire, although imperial power needed to be radically transformed so India had more autonomy. After the war, he became an early advocate of a total break with Britain, when religious violence racked the subcontinent during the 1920s, where Lajpat Rai was one of the first prominent nationalists to call for India to be split up, arguing that the division of India into four or five states would allow India's different communities to coexist and develop together. Peaceful separation would, he thought, create more lasting union than enforced homogeneity. The important thing was to work to uplift one's own community, not seize control of the commanding heights of the state. And this is a kind of vision of politics that doesn't have political sovereignty at its core, I think. Making these kind of arguments in the first quarter of the 20th century, political leaders and thinkers like Lajpat Rai were, I'd argue, participating in a worldwide conversation critical of the absolutist pretensions of a conquering imperial state and its domestic metropolitan cognates. As Corinna Mantena notes, the pluralist critique of the state particularly influenced the work of Radhakumar Mukherjee, for example, who particularly influenced Gandhi. But I'd make the broader point that this kind of pluralist critique of the claims of what these people called traditional state sovereignty provided a common ground for Indian political thought until at least the Great Depression. The work of the French jurist Léon Duguid, I don't know how you pronounce his name, was particularly pulled into Indian debates as in debate in other places. Duguid's thinking had no place for the concept of sovereignty at all. So Lajpat Rai positively refers to him, as do many others. He denied that the state was anything other than the particular group of people who happened to exercise coercive power at any point in time. The legitimacy of any political act depended on whether or not it was performed in response to a social need, and this duty could as easily be performed by dispersed social institutions as by sovereign powers. Such thinking had created, quote, a new epoch in the history of the state, as Harold Laski, hugely influential figure in India, put it. The idea that power could be exercised outside political institutions, that as Laski put it, the life of the community can no longer be contained in or satisfied with its political achievement, was obviously appealing to the ambitious subjects of a regime in India where foreigners monopolised political power. So I think the history of Indian political thought during the first half of the 20th century, particularly the 1910s and 1920s, is a kind of fascinating field that needs to be, needs a lot more work. Indian attitudes towards the state or politics are much more complicated and not always what we think they are. But my concern today is more with the practical life of power. My point is that the effort to regenerate Indian life outside the orbit of India's British conquest state, what I'm calling the unconquering of India, if anyone can think of a more elegant phrase than please do, generated a strata of new institutions that went on to powerfully shape the history of the post-imperial subcontinent. The late 19th century saw the growth of a variety of cultural and religious bodies that we've already mentioned, but we shouldn't privilege the cultural or inner, to use Partha Chatterjee's phrase, as the sphere where national practices were first developed. The Punjab National Bank was succeeded by the foundation of hundreds of nationalist Indian financial institutions, particularly in the Swadeshi years and then in the 1920s. All but a few designed to serve geographically specific communities, and with the exception of a few private institutions created in the 1990s and 2000s, those kind of nationalist Swadeshi institutions constitute India's present-day banking sector. New schools and colleges were also founded, the Indian Institute of Science by Mysore State, those that led to Jadavpur University, etc. But semi-autonomous spaces were carved out of imperial, in inverted commas, universities too. Allahabad University was a centre for nationalist history and political science in the 1920s. Calcutta University is supposed to have been called Goldigir Golamkhana, the slave house of Goldigi in the late 1920s. But when led by Ashutosh Mukherjee in the 1910s and early 20s, it's many of its departments saw nation building as its purpose, as their purpose. Despite his opposition to the non-cooperation movement, Mukherjee himself resigned as vice-chancellor in protest at the imperial government's efforts to impose its sovereign power on the university. So these different kind of Indian-run bodies were institutions run by elites which, unlike the imperial state, saw themselves as maintaining a dialogue with India's broader population. How far they actually did so is obviously open to question. So let me sort of draw to a close and make some comments really about how this relates to kind of how one might think about kind of sort of post-imperial situation. I've suggested that kind of one needs to think about empire and the British Empire in India kind of as in terms of thinking about a series of institutions concerned to maintain kind of British sovereign authorities, British sovereignty, and that through that the capacity to continually sort of to wield violence at the moment of exception is vital. And kind of that, you know, this importance of sovereignty, not of economic interests, not of, you know, cultural domination, not of anything else, kind of, I think makes the transfer of power, however what we might want to describe at the moment of decolonization, I'm trying not to use that word, but kind of, you know, sort of independence and the creation of a new state as a far more cataclysmic event, certainly for the British, than we might otherwise think. If the British own India in order to maintain their sovereignty, when sovereignty goes, there's a big change, obviously. And the best evidence of that is that is to look at what happens in kind of around 46, 47, and how British officers saw the end of empire, and most importantly, the kind of rapidity with which they all but a very, very small number simply fled, this extraordinary kind of sort of rapid exodus from, through the summer of, summer of 1947, with very few remaining into 1948. A few kind of British officers, of course, stayed on, mostly soldiers and some other officials in Pakistan, where the new Muslim state's military viability got sort of entangled within nascent Cold War politics, and kind of there's an idea somehow or other that kind of Pakistan's frontier is something that matters to Britain too. But otherwise, there's no there's no sense of kind of any sort of interest at stake, and so the British simply leave. There's very little sense of a broader civilizational mission or even kind of moral purpose. Questions of the vital questions are those of sovereignty and mastery, dominance and subordination. As the Punjab officer Edward Wakefield put it, "I'd spent my life in the service of the Crown and did not dispose to serve another master." And I want to kind of suggest, though, then that this kind of perspective that I've offered, then sort of means that we need to think about the very complicated inheritance of South Asia's two post-imperial states are left with. On the one hand, India and Pakistan are left with the kind of institutions of bureaucratic government and coercion, with the collectorates that are still there, the revenue systems, kind of military, judicial system, and so forth. Some Indians involved in kind of constitution building and so forth certainly imagine are more powerful than they actually were. Same is true for Pakistan, and those are no doubt important. But I think there's a tendency, I think, perhaps to kind of overestimate, to emphasise the centrality, the institutions that are sort of bequeathed, I suppose, to the post-imperial regimes by the imperial state, and not talk about anything else. And so I suppose kind of assume too much kind of continuity. And I suppose I want to kind of suggest, though, that there is a second kind of institutional tier, really, and a set of sort of practices and so forth, which kind of are built out of this sort of you know, kind of attempt to sort of unconquer, to sort of challenge the sort of conquering authority of kind of political, of British political power, whether it's kind of the banking system, whether it's, you know, sort of religious reform movements, you know, kind of whether it's sort of like alternative judicial, you know, dispute resolution systems, you know, sort of educational institutions and so forth, which are kind of ostensibly at least ruled by a very different kind of logic. That they're, you know, kind of about trying to, they're elite-led, certainly, absolutely, you know, kind of elite-dominated, but they're kind of sort of, they nominally at least to kind of reach out to a broader population, and they're places where, the, I suppose, the kind of logic of violence and conquest are supposed not to, to kind of reign in the same kind of way, and where, you know, consensus is seen as kind of as vital, and they, those, I think, powerfully shape the kind of, the patterns of post-imperial, you know, kind of sort of politics. I think we need to kind of revise a bit how we see, and here I'm just talking about India, kind of India's kind of post-partition modernity, and think about it particularly around about something that has to do with the creation of a kind of series of institutions that are about creating a kind of shared sense of national purpose, you know, sort of rather simply than, you know, the kind of usual stuff that we hear about, the kind of big dams, the kind of, you know, technical expertise and so forth, which matter, but, you know, in some senses are a kind of continuing legacy of empire and are criticised. Dams aren't as important as we might think. Nehru talks far more about community development, for example, than he does about kind of about, you know, the large kind of sort of infrastructure projects. There's, you know, kind of, you know, there's a kind of consensual style of political change, I guess, that is important to things like how land reform is managed, you know, kind of to the relationship between kind of business and the state. You know, kind of this is the late 40s and 50s are not an area of nationalisation. They're kind of an area in which there's an attempt to create some kind of you know, shared sort of shared sense of direction, kind of institutions that you know, sort of involve, you know, kind of private institutions kind of engaging in for public purposes. So I guess here I suppose, kind of going back to the place I began, you know, we have maybe the origins of what Gunnar Myrdal called India's soft state. We have the origins of a kind of sort of regime which is not interested in kind of imposing its will unilaterally on India's elites in order to kind of you know, kind of benefit the poor or whatever, but is, you know, kind of is based kind of around a kind of politics that you know, kind of which has eschewed violence, which is kind of interested in kind of creating stable institutions beyond the kind of realm of formal political power, you know, kind of and contains some kind of you know, kind of nonetheless prospect of development or whatever, nonetheless. And it's that sort of like that sort of idiom, I suppose, you know, kind of which often gets treated and I think rightly described as a sort of Gandhian style of politics or whatever. It's, you know, sort of is I think important, far more important perhaps than one might think to kind of the first 20 years of India's independence. And it's something that is vigorously challenged, kind of vigorously is in crisis and kind of is sort of like you know, impugned as kind of as allowing the kind of continuation of a sort of elites in power and so forth in the kind of late 1960s and 1970s. I suppose my suggestion perhaps is that kind of what's going on really is a critique of a certain kind of anti-imperial style of politics, not of the kind of legacies of the colonial regime, but how that style you know, kind of institution and why it fell out of favour is, I think, subject for a different paper. So,
thank you very much.